The court has one case on its oral submission docket. We'll make a tape of it for anybody that wants to purchase a tape for the nominal fee. And the appellant may reserve a portion of argument time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. This is a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. It's titled Grapevine Excavation Incorporated versus Maryland Lloyds. The court is ready to hear argument from appellant.
May it please the court, Mr. Patrick Polinski will present argument for the appellant. The appellant has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. As Chief Justice Phillips indicated, this is a case involving a certified question from the Fifth Circuit. And just to state that question real briefly, it's whether an insurer which is found to have breached its policy contract with its insured is liable for attorney's fees under Chapter 38 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code where application of the subsections of Section 38.006 does not authorize the recovery of fees.
Let me ask you this. For the exceptions in 38.006, if an insurer does not provide coverage, and a court later determines that, well, by golly, the insurer was supposed to provide coverage, would attorney's fees be recoverable under any of those five exceptions for that scenario?
Your Honor, there's a possibility. I think there would have to be more than a mere breach of a policy contract. For example, in this case, my client Grapevine's contention was that Maryland breached the contract by refusing to defend the underlying lawsuit against Grapevine. There was not a violation of Article 21.21, which would be the primary statute which would apply here to a liability insurer, because we did not contend that they engaged in false or deceptive practices or unfair claims settlement practices, Your Honor. So there are many instances where there's a breach of a policy contract, but not a violation of those enumerated statutes in the exception.
So as far as you know, if the insurer says either I'm not going to defend you or I'm not going to provide coverage, and you have to go to court to get a court to say, yes, insurance company, you have to either defend or provide coverage, the only avenue is that lawsuit on the contract. There are none of these other avenues that are set out in 006.
That's true, Your Honor. That's our position. And we believe that that's based upon the plain language of the statute and also the legislative history of the predecessor statute, which is Article 2226 of the Texas Revised Statutes. Policies behind insurance law in the state of Texas, primarily an insurer's broad duty to defend and the dependence of an insured upon that insurer for protection. And lastly, the case law. There's a dozen cases in Texas from the courts of appeals that have upheld this reading, an affirmative reading, that where an insured has no recourse against the carrier under those five listed exceptions, but there's yet a breach of contract, the insured is entitled to recover its attorney's fees.
Well, you could have one of those without having a breach of contract, isn't that correct?
That's possible, Your Honor.
Right.
It's certainly possible.
The court says if you make a false misrepresentation,
sure,
then the inducement, that's not on the contract, is it?
Well, I think what you, I hate to say this, Your Honor, but it would probably depend on the facts, because if misrepresentation turns out to turn on whether there was coverage or not for a claim, well, and the carrier takes the position
But would you agree that 2121 is a statutory cause of action, not necessarily based upon breach of contract?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. No, there's no
and
question
it provides about it. Specific remedies, including attorney's fees.
Right, Your Honor.
So you could sue under 2121 without ever mentioning breach of contract.
That's true, Your Honor.
By the same token, you could go the other way and sue for coverage or defense without ever mentioning 2121.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what happened here.
You mentioned that the plain language supports your argument. Can you give me your
argument? Okay, Your Honor, if we look at the exact language of 38.006, the exception, it says this chapter does not apply to a contract issued by an insurer that is subject to the provisions of, and it goes down a list of the laundry list of the insurance code. The key language there is subject to. What does subject to mean? Does subject to mean that the carrier is merely regulated by Article 2121, that the policy is issued and Article 2121 would apply, as is the case here with Maryland, and as is the case with most, I would venture to guess, most liability carriers in Texas? They are regulated by Article 2121, no question. Or does subject to mean subject to liability for attorney's fees under the statute?
Or could it be this? This chapter does not apply to a contract that is subject to the provisions of 1 through 5. It says contract issued by an insurer. It's hard to tell from the language here. Obviously, they're talking about a contract issued by an insurer, but you're talking, though, as though whether or not the insurer is subject to the provisions of 1 through 5. My question is, would a clear reading of this statutory provision be that this chapter does not apply to a contract that is subject to the provisions of 1 through 5? And if I understand what you said earlier, the contract situation in this case is not subject to the provisions of 1 through 5.
Your Honor, our position, I think the first position you stated, that subject to means an insurer is subject to Article 2121 and the other five exceptions, that's the position of Maryland, I believe. Our position is that subject to those provisions means that they're subject to liability for attorney's fees in the context of Section 30 or Chapter 38 overall, which is an attorney's fees statute.
How does that apply to the fifth exception?
Your Honor, I believe I indicated in my brief that the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act, Your Honor.
The sixth.
Pardon me?
Chapter 9.
Chapter 9. I have a hard time explaining why that section is here. I have read the legislative history, and I honestly will stand here and say I don't have an answer to that question.
But it seems to me your plain meaning argument at least hits a snag if it doesn't run aground on that Chapter 9 exception.
It does, Your Honor, but if you look in the legislative history, the legislature in the debates and in the bill analysis, there was kind of a dichotomy between insurers subject to the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act and Article 2121 and old Article 3.62 under health and accident policies, and then the title companies. Is the title company, that's a purely a regulatory statute. Now, Article 21.21-2 is a regulatory statute also, but it does apply. It does provide for attorney's fees to the state board in the event they have to enforce, bring an action against a carrier.
I have difficulty under the plain reading. The way the statute's written, if it was written as a gap filler, which is your argument that you get attorney's fees under 38.006 unless you get attorney's fees under some other statute, it just doesn't make sense. The legislature would have just would not have excluded insurers from 38.006 for contract actions. On the other hand, if they didn't want insurers to be liable for attorney's fees, why didn't they just exclude them in 38.006? Because that wouldn't have in any way conflicted with 2121. I mean, 38.006 is the way you get attorney's fees unless there's some other law that provides attorney's fees. So your reading of it seems to me to not make much sense. I mean, I just don't understand it that way.
Your Honor, perhaps it's better termed as a common sense reading when you look at the overall purpose of Chapter 38, which is to provide access to the courts for for parties who would otherwise be unable to pay for an attorney. That's in the legislative history, Your Honor. Mr. Cooper has pointed that out in Maryland's brief, and it's been pointed out in our reply brief. So if that's the purpose, why would the legislature go ahead and exclude virtually every insurance company from the ambit of Chapter 38, from an obligation to pay attorney's fees through these exceptions? I think the common sense reading is that subject to means subject to liability for attorney's fees with regard to this claim.
You're saying it would be unreasonable for the legislature to decide it would be in the best public policy to exclude insurance companies?
Excuse me, Your Honor,
Are you saying it would be unreasonable for the legislature to determine that it would be in the best public policy not to have insurance companies be subject to this provision?
Yeah, Your Honor, that's our position, and there's support for that in the legislative history. In the group bill analysis, the author raised a problem with that exclusion. It said the proposal to exclude certain insurance contracts and insurers from Article 2226 is an unwarranted grant of immunity from liability for attorney's fees. They should pay like everybody else when they lose. And I think it's particularly appropriate for insurance companies who have in a liability, particularly in this case with Grapevine. Maryland had an obligation to defend Grapevine in the underlying lawsuit as found by the Fifth Circuit. Maryland did not do that.
Isn't there legislative history, though, that this language was an amendment and the sponsor stood up and said, we've taken the insurance companies out and most of them will pay attorney's fees anyway?
That's what they said, Your Honor, and I think that's support.
Doesn't that cut very strongly against you, that they knew what they were doing and they were willing to let some people, like your client, fall through the cracks?
Your Honor, I think that could be read to indicate just the opposite. But what they deal with and what the sponsor states is that they wanted to avoid an overlapping of attorney's fees. I think you don't get an overlapping of attorney's fees unless attorney's fees are awarded. And they say in most instances carriers would be subject to attorney's fees.
They also say they're going to cut insurance companies out from this general statute.
That's true, they do, Your Honor, and they usually follow that up with a statement indicating the issue about overlapping with the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act and the other sections that allowed insurers to recover attorney's fees.
Would your viewpoint be the same if the circumstances were reversed here, such as Maryland sued Grapevine under a situation where Maryland was alleging Grapevine breached their policy, for instance, failed to notify Maryland that a suit had been filed, and so there's a default, and Grapevine says, cover me, and y'all say, we don't have to because you breached the contract. Would Maryland be able to get attorney's fees against your client on a suit for no coverage under those circumstances because it's a breach of contract? Doesn't it cut both ways? Shouldn't it?
Sure, Your Honor, I believe it does, and I think if
that's the case under that exception situation, why would they say when they're talking about the bill, well, this makes insurance companies not able to get, quote, attorney's fees in their lawsuits, close quote.
Your Honor, you said why wouldn't they?
They did
mention that in the legislative history.
And so they thought that that's what they were doing here, but the language doesn't, it can't lead you to that conclusion based on where you're coming from, I don't think.
Well, I think it could lead to the conclusion that under an appropriate circumstance, there could be a recovery of attorney's fees for an insured's breach of contract. I would submit that that's going to be highly unlikely in these situations.
Well, but we're talking about what the legislature said in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're of the viewpoint that this statute allows any policyholder to get attorney's fees from the insurance company for breach of contract, you certainly can't read it to say that it excludes attorney's fees for insurance companies that sue their policyholders for breach of contract, can you?
No, Your Honor. I agree.
Whatever
with
it is, if they win, they get fees too.
Mr. Walensky, when was this provision added to Article 2226?
1977, Your Honor.
Has there been any state court, reported state court decision that has denied an insured
recovery of attorney's fees as the insurance company argues in this case?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. There's
been the regular practice that attorney's fees are sought, and if an insured prevails, they recover them, provided that they're not pursuing an Article 2121 claim?
I believe that's the case, Your Honor. I think this court has acted on certain of those cases, and in situations where they have allowed attorney's fees, where if this type of reasoning were adopted, they would have been denied.
Do you know whether or not insurance companies routinely do they rely upon this 38006 to try to avoid paying attorney's fees, or is this an issue that's contested by the industry? Or do you know?
Your Honor, in my experience, this issue comes up where I believe it gets thrown into the mix in a carrier's decision as to whether to remove a case to federal court in light of the way the Fifth Circuit has treated these cases, and now they've certified the question because I think the Fifth Circuit has gotten somewhat uncomfortable with the denial of the attorney's fees, which prompted the certification.
Well, this court has directly held in accord with your interpretation, has it not?
Your Honor, to honestly respond, I don't believe it is squarely held.
What is the Burke case then? It's affirming
the Burke case,
that CA is correct. What does the Burke case do?
Well, our position is that the Burke case does basically uphold that type of that recovery because of the per curiam of.
Well, it says it's correct. How's that kind of basically, kind of? I mean, didn't this court say that's correct?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I fell victim to Mr. Cooper's brief. No, I think it does, Your Honor. I think they've adopted Burke, and I think there's a subsequent case that cites Barnett versus Aetna case, subsequently cites the Hernandez case, which is in the Burke line of court of appeals
cases. Barnett wasn't an issue, was it? What argued topside or bottom?
No, Your Honor. And that's the problem. Well, not the problem. That was the situation with most of the cases before this court, or in fact, all of them. It just wasn't argued. And this court has never squarely addressed the issue.
And in Burke, we didn't mention Article 2227.
But no, Your Honor, you didn't.
And we didn't read the case.
Right. And the per curiam opinion was another issue.
In Burke, that was the issue on motion rehearing in the CA. They were specifically talking about that.
Mm-hmm. That's true, Your Honor.
Hernandez does talk about that.
Yes, sir.
Directly.
Pardon me?
The Hernandez case talks about it directly.
It does, Your Honor.
Which was relied on by our court in Barnett.
Right. That's true.
Well, why do you think we keep writing about it if we're not ever there? It never presented directly.
Well, Your Honor, I've always taken the position that this court has upheld the award of attorney's fees. The question is, in the Fifth Circuit's mind, it has not. And
But the Fifth Circuit draws its support solely from Dairyland.
Right.
Is that a correct statement?
Your Honor, I think the statement about exemptions of certain insurance companies from 38006, it's a unique case because that was a county mutual insurance company, and the statute specifically said they weren't subject to Article 2121, which is not the case now. And that's a different situation than the typical case where you find a carrier that's denied coverage. Article 21.21 applies.
Refresh my memory. Was 3.62 in effect when Dairyland was decided?
Your Honor, I don't
think why that is. There were at least six subparts of what applies under the exception, and so it's not just limited to 2121.
That's true.
And we do know that county mutuals under 1722 are effectively excluded from anything having to do with an insurance law unless they're specifically mentioned. And so that could certainly have been the basis of what the court decided in Dairyland, that county mutuals just out, period.
I think that's an accurate statement of what the
court
decided.
Later was brought in when it was made subject to under the current 1722 Article 2121. And that you could just stop there with that. was that why you think that the Fifth Circuit's gone astray in it, too, in this case in Lafarge?
I think it has, Your Honor. And even the Lafarge case, I think they were somewhat hesitant. They expressed a lot of concerns about denying the attorney's fees and stated that only because of the internal rules of the Fifth Circuit were they unable to overrule another panel unless and until the highest court of Texas had ruled on the issue.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Appalachia.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Cooper will present argument for the Appalachia.
Mr. Cooper, can you give me a realistic scenario where an insurer would sue an insured for breach of contract?
Where an insurer would sue an insured for breach of contract? Yes,
because
I can.
I understand your argument is there's reason to the legislature carving out insurance companies because you're protecting insureds from attorney's fees. Right.
I tried a case last January in Judge Sanders' court in Dallas where we sued the insured for breach of the duty to fairly, completely disclose information with respect to applications. We're saying you breached the contract, you breached your obligations, and that would excuse our performance under the contract. In that case,
what are your damages?
Well, first off, you're seeking, as in the Bird case, they were seeking specific performance. We were seeking cancellation of the policy, but ancillary to that, we were also seeking the issue of attorney's fees.
So there are no damages. You're really seeking a declaratory judgment. Is what you're seeking.
Well, you're seeking cancellation, which I think is an equitable remedy.
And how did the court rule in that case? How'd you fare there?
We won. We had our contract declared null and void, and we did not get our attorney's fees.
Mr. Cooper, can we talk about Burke?
Sure.
This court decided this issue in Burke?
I don't believe it has, Your Honor. I believe this court has decided the issue in the only case that's squarely addressed it, which was the Childress case. But let's talk about Burke for a second. In the Burr case, the Texarkana Court of Appeals said the way they interpreted this statute was that the 2226 would not apply only when the insured was seeking attorney's fees under one of the five enumerated statutes. We know that the legal reasoning that was applied in Burr was erroneous because we know at least two of those statutes do not allow an insured to seek attorney's fees.
Well, but can you answer Judge Gonzalez's question in terms of the language in which this court said that Burke was... You may disagree with Texarkana and Burke, but this court said that Texarkana correctly decided Burke. Why isn't that precedent that goes against your position in this case?
Because it was an NRE case, what that means, as this court's well aware, that this court was not necessarily satisfied that the Court of Appeals correctly decided the law, but...
Well, in that case, we said the Court of Civil Appeals has correctly decided the case, which is a little bit unusual.
And the result, and the question is, and again, I was, I don't guess anyone here was on the court back then, but the question was there some other grounds, for example, for the award of attorney's fees? And I think it's important, if you look at the Bird case, if you look on the first paragraph, you see what the award was. The petition sought further either damages, specific performance, or declaratory judgment. The trial court rendered judgment declaring that Prudential had this obligation to change the beneficiary, and the question was whether or not this court determined that since it was a declaratory judgment action, that perhaps even though attorney's fees were not appropriate under 2226, they may have been appropriate under the declaratory judgment statute.
Do you agree with Mr. Walensky that since Burke, which is almost, I guess, 20 years old now, that the courts of appeals have uniformly then followed Burke in allowing an award of attorney's fees in the manner in which the appellant argues today?
I don't think it is uniform. I think it goes both.
What courts of appeals decisions in Texas have gone against Burke?
Well, I'm trying to think. It was not Hernandez, but one of the other ones says, basically, we think the plain language of this statute says if you're one of the enumerated, if you fall within one of the enumerated categories, you can't get the attorney's fees. And
there's one court of appeals decision that goes your way?
Correct. And we've got two Supreme Court decisions we believe that goes our way.
But then the rest of the court of appeals decisions, though, have followed Burke.
I
have not done an analysis of the Court of Appeals decisions, but I can't cite you any right now.
Let me just put this on the table then. I mean, we're looking at almost 20 years post-Burke with the statute on the book having been codified in the face of Burke on the record at that point in time. How many cases, Court of Appeals decisions, would we have to disapprove if we were to adopt your position in this case?
Well, actually, there was a decision that was decided before Burke from the Houston Court of Appeals. The Standard Fire versus Freeman, which was in 1979, where the Houston 14th said that if you are subject to one of those provisions, you're not entitled to attorney's fees. That's one, and I believe there have been some since then.
But that argument is inconsistent with your provision and consistent with his provision.
No, the way I read the Freeman case, Your Honor, was that if the insurance company was subject to one of the five provisions of 2226 or Chapter 38, that you could not get attorney's fees. And that is the argument we're making here, that if the insurer is subject to those provisions, then attorney's fees are not available.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm just trying to get the lay of the land in terms of if we go with your position in this case. How many Court of Appeals decisions would we have to disapprove of to adopt your view of the statute?
I have not done a count, but I would agree with the Court. There are more Court of Appeals decisions following saying you can get attorney's fees than saying you cannot.
And would we have to overrule Burke?
I don't believe you would have to overrule Burke.
What would we do with Burke, then, since it's been precedent for all those Court of Appeals decisions?
Again, Burke is an NRE case, which
I understand. I just want to know what we are supposed to do with it since everybody's been following it.
Well, the other question is, what do you do with Childress? And what do you do with...
Just get an answer to my question first, and then I'll let you move on, and you can talk about Childress, just so I can get square on putting all the pieces
together. The way that I think Burke is handled is to say that we agree with the result, not necessarily the reasoning. And since, for example, we don't know if the court that heard this case concluded that attorney's fees were appropriate, for example, under the declaratory judgment statute, which was the basis for the trial court's judgment, that even though the result was correct, the reasoning was not correct.
Okay. I think your language, plain reading argument under 38.006 or 2226, I think is probably correct. It probably is that the legislature probably did intend not to allow attorney's fees to be recovered against insurance companies for whatever reason. I won't raise a specter, maybe a special law, but set that aside for the time being. Let's assume that's the case. You keep talking about Burke being an NRE case. Burke is not an NRE case. Burke is a decision out of this court that the Texarkana court's decision was correct. And then we go on and talk about something else. Then we put an NRE on it. But we actually pronounce that an opinion is correct in the Court of Appeals. So it seems to me that we have to deal with our decision, not Texarkana's decision, but our decision reflected in Burke. It seems to me that's plain language also, pretty much plain language. And then you come to our statutory interpretation rules that say if we've interpreted a statute a given way, and over time the legislature hasn't come back and responded by changing the statute, doesn't that, regardless of what the courts of appeals have done, doesn't that leave your argument that we ought to go back behind Burke and say the statute really didn't mean it? It seems to me if the legislature didn't like Burke, they would have changed it over 20 years. Don't you face that argument?
Well, two things, if I could, Your Honor. First off, this court has never cited Burke with approval on that point. This court has never once followed Burke. You can look at Childress, you can look at Barnett, you can look at Mayfield, you can look at all the cases, and this court never has followed Burke. With respect to the...
That's different, whether it's followed it or whether it's cited it with approval. This court has allowed recovery of attorney's fees in this situation.
Well, let me ask you this.
Not a question on the panel.
Go ahead.
Hold that thought.
The one thing before I forget, and I will forget, there have been, if you check the 95th, the 93rd legislatures, there have been amendments entered by the legislature trying to change Chapter 38, and none of those have passed, where they would remove for example, the laundry list there. And none of those have passed. So, I mean, I think the argument about the legislature's inaction, I think, is rebutted by the fact that these bills have been introduced and none of these bills have ever been passed by the legislature.
Let me ask you this. Give me an example of a case where an insurer has a contract dispute with the insurer and is able to recover attorney's fees.
Declaratory judgment. The problem we have in this case is...
If the insurer brings the deck action, saying there is no coverage or no duty to defend, and loses on that, you're saying the insurer can recover attorney's fees?
What I'm saying is if the insurer believes there's been a breach and wants to have the terms construed, at least under the State Declaratory Judgment Act, attorney's fees can be recovered. Now, the problem we have in this case is that the suit was brought in federal court, and there's a Fifth Circuit case called Utica Mutual, which says you cannot get attorney's fees in a federal declaratory judgment
action. My question is this. Under a state declaratory judgment action, what's the authority for recovering attorney's fees?
There is a specific provision in Chapter 37 of the Civil Practice Ordinance Code.
Precisely. Here's my point. Looking at 38006, says this chapter does not apply to a contract issued by an insurer that is subject to the provisions of 1 through 5. What your interpretation does causes 38006 to read this way. This chapter does not apply to a contract issued by an insurer, period.
No.
Then why, under your interpretation, why is the remainder not superfluous?
Because all insurers aren't subject to these provisions, just as this court noted in the
Gary Andrews. You haven't given me an example other than a deck action. There is no example I can think of, but none that you provided, whereby an insurer could obtain attorney's fees from an insurer concerning a dispute for the insurance agreement unless attorney's fees are otherwise provided by some other statutory provision.
Dairyland versus Childress. In that case, under 17.2 of the, 2.2 of the insurance code, county mutuals were not subject to, at that time, the 2121 or 2121-2. And this court held that since they weren't subject to those provisions, then they were subject to 2226, and attorney fees could be recovered for breach of contract.
But now they are.
Now they are. That's correct.
And so, but as we stand here today, you can't think of a single cause of action where an insurer could recover attorney's fees against an insurer for a breach of an insurance contract unless attorney's fees is otherwise provided under some other statutory provision.
Well, I'm not so sure that the five categories that we have here cover all the different lines of insurance.
Okay, I'm taking then that your answer to my question is no, you can't think of any other examples.
I can't give you an example right now, but I'm not conceding that there are no examples where you could have an insurance contract not subject to this. And again, I think it's important to look at what the legislature was facing back in 1977. Before 1977, the law was unless the contract provided for the recovery of attorney's fees, neither party could get recovery of attorney's fees for a breach of the contract. The TDI, Texas Department of Insurance, was charged with that knowledge, and for years and years and years, the TDI never saw fit to change the insurance forms in Texas to allow for the recovery of attorney's fees by the prevailing party. And I think the reason, and again, we don't have any decisions or anything saying why, but I think the reason why there was never any action by the TDI was so as not to subject the insured to the claim for attorney's fees. Under all these statutes, 2121, 362, 362-1, it allows the insured to get attorney's fees, but not the insurer. 2121, the insurer can't get it. It's a bad faith cause of action, but it's very narrow. And I think
that seems to me to be pretty clear. If you provide a statutory cause of action for a person who's been wronged by a company that issues insurance policies, and they sue them for that basis, why should the offending party be entitled to get attorney's fees? I don't see how it cuts both ways, the way these 2121 and 2121-2 are set up.
Well, if I understand your question correctly, and what my understanding of what the legislature was trying to do was say, okay, the insureds can sue under these statutes, they can get their attorney's fees, but the insurance company cannot, by some reciprocal statute, get their attorney's fees except in very, very narrow situations under Section 16C of 2121 where it's been brought in bad faith or for the purpose of harassment.
But Mr. Cooper, as you've mentioned, the state declaratory judgment statute would allow a trial court to award attorney's fees in a deck action for either party.
Correct.
So the insured, in most instances, if an insurance company is suing an insured, it's to try to nullify the contract in some way, and it's primarily in the nature of a deck action. When would an insurance company sue an insured for damages?
Well, for example, if they're...
An insurance company sue an insured.
Insurance company sue an insured?
Yeah, the point is that you're saying... My point of this is that you're saying that the legislature was acting with this statute to protect insureds. And I find that really hard to follow when, in fact, most breach of contract actions are going to be by insureds against insurance companies for failing to perform under the contract. And in fact, when an insurance company sues an insured, which isn't that often, it typically is in the form of a deck action that allows recovery of attorney's fees against the insured anyway. So I have a real hard time following your argument that this was some sort of a statute designed to protect insureds.
Well, if you look at the analysis put out by the committee, it says in the commentary, subparagraph 6, presumably then, such companies could not take advantage of the provisions of 2226 for recovering attorney's fees in their own lawsuits. So, as part of the legislature...
Don't you agree that most of these actions are going to be insured against insurance companies?
I agree.
We rule your way, the insurance companies are going to benefit more than the insureds are. Isn't that the reality of it?
I think most of the cases are filed by insureds against insurance companies. However, the legislature, again, was free to...
My question is, isn't that actually the result of the decision that this would benefit insurance companies more than insurers?
Insurance companies are sued more often than...
So the answer is yes.
The answer would be yes.
Okay.
But, again, I believe the legislature was free to draft the statute as they saw fit. And I think, again, one of the things that... Mr. Walensky said, when they did the bill analysis, they talked about some of the criticisms of the bill that was going to be passed. In this bill, they had these criticisms, and they passed the bill despite the criticisms. And one of the criticisms, as far as the cons in the analysis, was that the proposal to exclude certain insurance contracts and insurers from Article 2226 is an unwarranted grant of immunity from liability for attorney's fees. And so this was one of the facts that the legislature knew would be the case if they passed the statute, and despite the fact that this immunity would attach, they nonetheless passed the statute.
Are you aware of any other industry or any other trade group that's exempt from paying attorney's fees in this situation?
For a breach of contract, written oral contract, obviously... You have certain governmental entities that are immune from attorney's fees by statute or other statutes.
But any other trade group or any other industry?
None that I can think of right off the top.
Why in the world would the legislature say insurance agencies, we're going to give you this plum and keep you from having to pay attorney's fees? I've heard your argument that it's to protect insurers, but I tend to agree with Justice Hankinson that that's a hard one to accept, considering the realities of the deck actions and things. So can you think of any reason why they would wholesale give this immunity, so to speak, to insurance companies?
Because they felt like the insureds had adequate protection under the statutes that were cited. Attorney's fees were already available. But if there were insurance companies who were not doing what they should be doing, then under appropriate circumstances, relief, including attorney's fees, could be recovered under those statutes.
In cases like this, how is the insured adequately protected? Why is the insured not at the mercy of the money muscle of the insurance company?
I would hope that every person who comes into a court of law would have equal standing.
Well, some people are more capable of affording causing the other side to have to go to the court of law.
Well, I think in the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen some of the judgments, and there's been numerous ones before this court, as far as the large awards where the insurance companies have not conducted themselves appropriately. And I think that threat, that error exists still today with respect to insurance carriers. That if you don't, an insurer can go into court and have to accept a jury.
Why shouldn't that hammer apply to breach of contract?
Because, again, the legislature did not see fit to track
the number. I'm talking about why, as a policy matter, wouldn't that hammer apply to a breach of contract? Because can't insurance companies then just deny coverage and risk that the insured can't afford to bring a lawsuit for coverage? I mean, why wouldn't that hammer to protect insurers apply equally to breach of contract?
Because now we have, in 1995, Article 21.21, subsection 410, adopted the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act as part of Article 21. And if there is a denial of a claim without a reasonable basis, the insured now is afforded the opportunity to sue,
well,
to get attorney's fees, and to get additional damage.
Are you saying that this case could have been brought under that section?
I'm saying this case could have been brought under that statute.
There was no reasonable basis for the insurance company to deny?
Well, I mean, I don't think they're going to be able to make that because the district judge...
Well, I think that's what you just said, that in order to come under that statute, there has to be no reasonable basis.
There has to be no reasonable...
But this case would apply.
I don't believe that the facts of this case would fall in that statute because particularly we have a district judge agreeing that the position adopted by Maryland was the correct position. So I think it would be hard to say that there was no reasonable basis when the federal judge said we were right.
So it wouldn't fit under that?
My opinion would not fit in the statute. That's correct.
Any other questions?
Yes. I want to get back to your answer to Justice Ennis about Burke. You're very clearly asked this court to overrule Burke, and one of your arguments is that this court has never directly construed this statute. What about Barnett? The reason why I ask about Barnett, it clearly says that we're going to look at this recovery for attorney's fees under Section 38001 and cites Hernandez as support for awarding attorney's fees in the Barnett case. And when you read Hernandez, Hernandez has a long discussion about Burke and follows it when it awards attorney's fees. It seems to me that's a pretty direct ruling by this court that it supports Burke.
First, my position is not that this court has never directly addressed it, because I believe the court did in the Childress case on Burke.
Well, but would you agree that Childress is distinguishable because Dairyland was a county mutual, and it's a whole ball game different with county mutuals than it is other insurers?
Well, but the logic, I believe, in Childress would apply, and then you go back to the Mayfield case, and I think the court also followed up there. But with respect to the Barnett, just to answer your question, I went to the problem of pulling the briefs in Barnett, and in Barnett, the insurer stipulated to the amount of attorney's fees, and if you look at what was brought before this court, the insurance company in that case did not contest the ability to recover attorney's fees under 2226. Their only position that was before this court was that we think we should win, therefore we're not liable for attorney's fees. The issue of whether or not this exception to 2226 should apply was never raised by the insurance company in Barnett. If you go back to the briefs in that case, you'll see that it was never briefed. It was never raised in response to the points of error.
Any other questions?
So what your view is then that what the court said at the end of Barnett is pure dicta?
It's pure dicta. It was not an issue that was in contention in that case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
To just address a couple of issues raised by the court with Mr. Cooper and Justice O'Neill, it is unfair. It's very unfair that Grapevine Excavation faces liability for attorney's fees to the general contractor.
Are we here to decide what's fair or what the legislature intended?
I think we can decide what the legislature meant to be fair, and I think
how do we get around what the history of the statute was?
Your Honor, I think the history does support this reading in that the overriding concern is access to the courts for parties who might not otherwise be able to pay for an attorney.
Well, it's been a little broader than that, but the idea is that they certainly have access to the court, but if you can't get attorney's fees on a contract, you don't get whole recovery. So that's true. That they had been excluded for some reason other than economics from coming to our courts.
Yes, Your Honor. And the other issues, when they do speak about the insurance exemption or the insurance exceptions, it's always in the context of ability to recover attorney's fees. And if you read that in the overall purpose of the statute, it's inconsistent that an entire industry like the insurance industry would be exempt. Virtually the entire industry would be exempt from this statute.
That's not unprecedented for the legislature.
Certainly not, Your Honor. It's not unprecedented.
Agree with you, does the court have to, in effect, add language such as Burke states to get where you want to go, to what that...
Your Honor, I'm not sure that Burke is adding any language. Last night I looked up what subject to means, subject to the provisions of those statutes, and subject to means... Now I have to get my notes, Your Honor. So it's interesting what it says. In Webster's dictionary, it says subject to means suffering a particular liability or exposure. Seems to me that dovetails into a particular liability for attorney's fees on that claim. Another issue, Judge Hankinson, in order to rule for Maryland or answer the certified question negatively, no fewer than 11 courts of appeals would have to be overruled. One of those is the Burke case. Another is the Chitsey case, which has been affirmed by this court. And two others have been a writ, an application was refused, no reversible error. The argument that somehow the insurance industry... Certainly not, Your Honor. It's not unprecedented.
Agree with you, does the court have to, in effect, add language such as Burke states to get where you want to go, to what that section?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that Burke is adding any language. Last night I looked up what subject to means, subject to the provisions of those statutes, and subject to means... Now I have to get my notes, Your Honor. So it's interesting what it says. In Webster's dictionary, it says subject to means suffering a particular liability or exposure. Seems to me that dovetails into a particular liability for attorney's fees on that claim. Another issue, Judge Hankinson, in order to rule for Maryland or answer the certified question negatively, no fewer than 11 courts of appeals would have to be overruled. One of those is the Burke case. Another is the Chitsey case, which has been affirmed by this court. And two others have been a writ, an application was refused, no reversible error. The argument that somehow the insurance industry is doing us a favor, the legislature did the insureds a favor by passing 38006 so that insurance companies cannot recover attorney's fees, I don't believe holds water.
Any other questions?
It's a permissive statute, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the defendant's case and concludes our morning docket. We'll now stand adjourned. Marshal, please.